You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of March, 2018, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
There is a train. It's now on its way back. We don't know if it was Kim Jong-un or Kim Kardashian.
So which Kim was heading from Pyongyang to Beijing and back? My guests, Linda Yu and Michael Binion, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the growing list of Russian diplomats being expelled and sent back to Moscow. The aftermath of that 60 Minutes interview on Donald Trump and why it hasn't become a bigger scandal yet. Plus, what is it acceptable to use your nationality as an excuse for? We'll be finding out. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome indeed to Midori House. My guests today are Linda Yu, broadcaster and author of The Great Economists, and Michael Binion, foreign affairs specialist for The Times in London. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. Now, the list of countries expelling Russian diplomats as part of the global response to the poisoning of Sergei Skripal in the UK keeps on growing. Australia has now become the latest country to do exactly that, adding, though it's mainly maybe reined back on this a little, that it was considering a boycott of the Football World Cup in Russia as well. Michael, to come to you first of all, more than 20 countries now, more than 100 diplomats. I guess regardless of whether many more follow, that is a significant number. Is it enough to actually be to the detriment of the global Russian intelligence operation?
Oh, certainly, yes. Because the people who've been kicked out are nearly all intelligence agents who've been identified by international security experts and by the host countries. And as in 1971, when Britain threw out 105 Soviet diplomats, which is the largest number ever thrown out in any one country, it tends to cripple the intelligence operation because these people are then named and they can't then be appointed to other countries because they will then say they're unacceptable, they won't take them in. So all that time and training in trying to get them to be useful spies is wasted. And if this is the case all around Europe and in America, it really does set back Russian intelligence quite a bit.
And Linda, it's interesting, isn't it? Because of course, Lavrov and others have said this is a provocation of Russia. But precisely as Michael describes there, it's way beyond that. And it degrades their ability to do the kind of work that they were doing before.
And I think it's a robust response to a really outrageous attack on British soil. So we've also had NATO say that they're decreasing the number of Russians in NATO down to, well, Michael and I were discussing this a moment ago, trying to work out the numbers, but around 20. So they've cut it by maybe a third. And I think that's always the issue with what Russia did this time, which is how the international community can respond in a way that doesn't launch a new Cold War, but makes it clear that they've stepped completely outside the bounds of international law and behaviour.
Well, Michael, to that point about international law and the niceties of this, it was quite telling, wasn't it, that when May, if we think back to when she said, look, you know, you have, was it 3 days to tell us what happened?
Yes.
2 days only. The Russians came back with on one reading, a rather reasonable thing, which was to say, well, hang on, if this is about chemical weapons, you must provide the evidence of that and furnish us with more information. And then we have, I think, was it 10 days to respond, which is all governed by the sort of UN-mandated behaviours. Has everybody decided that, without question, this is Russia, even though the evidence is, whilst compelling, not yet concrete?
Well, the thing is that May said, you have to explain, if it wasn't you, how come this Russian-made agent was used? So please tell us either how come that you didn't keep tight enough control of the agent, which is a perfectly reasonable question, or whether it was authorised. Now, she wasn't saying you have authorised it, but she was asking them to explain. Now, they didn't answer either question. So even if there wasn't the concrete evidence in front of their eyes, and of course it has been provided now to the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, it's a perfectly reasonable question. And all they did was make a lot of very sarcastic and sneering remarks and treated it with complete disdain. Now, I think that this angered, obviously, not only Britain, but other countries who've both seen a pattern of Russian behaviour in other areas. And this is why I think there was such a solid reaction to support Britain, because it's not only assassination on other people's soil, but it's the whole question of interfering in other people's media, in their networks, in their elections, and a whole lot of operations that don't conform to normal behaviour of a foreign state.
Linda, what about the US reaction? Because I guess some have expressed surprise at the scale of the response. It, you know, particularly there's obviously the backdrop of the ongoing Russia inquiry and so on. But what, 60 diplomats, 12 intelligence officers? We talk about a robustness of response. I mean, that's certainly robust. Does that surprise you given the backdrop? Or maybe did that backdrop contribute to the decision to do exactly that?
I wonder if the change in personnel in the US White House could explain some of it, because obviously you now have more hawkish figures in the form of John Bolton and Mike Pompeo. So I think there's always a slight schizophrenia in the way the U.S. deals with Russia. There's probably a divergence of opinion between the president and some of his staff. But I think that there was obviously a little hesitation on the part of the U.S. under President Trump initially to support Britain. But I think the staff have pushed, and I think the U.S. is now falling in line with the rest of the global community in trying to ensure that Russia knows this is unacceptable behavior. Now, one thing I found quite interesting, as I suspect this is not all of the sleeper agents that are in the United States or other countries. But then curiously, the New Zealand prime minister said they would have expelled the Russians, but they couldn't find any.
Yeah, we were laughing about that before. I don't know about whom that says the most, but it's an interesting detail. Michael, what about the view from the Kremlin, insofar as we can guess or speculate? Do you think that there was a miscalculation about the likely reaction? Because again, if you think back to what actually happened, if we are to assume that it was either sanctioned or it was through a lack of control of this agent and so forth, it was so brazen, it was so stark, it was surely designed as much for the reaction as to the impact on the hapless Sergei Skripal.
Yes.
Was there a miscalculation, do you think?
To some extent. I think they knew straight away that there would be uproar, and this would be useful just on the week leading up to the re-election of the president to show Russians that, look, the world is ganging up on us and the world is stirring an anti-Russian campaign and you need a strong man. I am the strong man who will defend Russian interests. Well, that's okay if they thought only Britain was going to actually do something. They may have calculated that the other European partners wouldn't be very vigorous in their support because they depend on Russian gas for a start. They don't want to disrupt trade relations, which are still quite considerable, energy supplies and things of that kind. I think they have been and are shaken by the scale of the Western reaction and the coordination of it, and the fact that the Western countries have added not just this incident in Salisbury in Britain, but all the other things that the Russians have been doing. Now, what I think they may do, obviously in public, there will be total defiance. They will not change their behaviour at all. Putin has made it a mark of his presidency that Russia does not back down, it is not to be humiliated, it does not respond to threats. But I think they might start doing something, for example, about these robots that are sending out fake news all over the place and trying to interfere in global social media, because they've now been clearly labelled and identified as Russian robots. And therefore, the value of these things is much reduced, because if everyone says, well, it's just, you know, Russian propaganda, and once they sort of say, well, that's not worth pursuing any further, that they might clamp down a bit on that. And I think they might be careful about not assassinating any more people overseas for a while.
Well, that's to be hoped. And to that broader point, and actually Michael alluded to it there, which is this trend that we've been witnessing for years now, which is Putin's playing to his domestic audience. And again, you know, we talk about America not really having a foreign policy under Trump, but Putin's foreign policy appears to be whatever is politically expedient for him in terms of retaining control domestically. Was the West too slow to recognise that or pivot to that reality? I was watching this programme about the last year of the Obama administration, and some of his long-term staffers were saying exactly this. We just didn't realise to what extent Putin simply didn't care what was best for Russia, but only what was best for Putin. Have we all been too slow arriving at that conclusion?
I think there's probably some element of truth to that, because he is, he has been for some time, really distorted the Russian political and social system. And yet there has been very little reaction. And I think in that sense, I think when a political leader steps outside the bounds of normal behavior, I think it's hard for the international community, who obviously are not internal to Russia. They're not really able to tell what's going on. They can kind of see the change, but it's still gradual. And I think we have, over the past few years, gotten to the point where it's quite clear that Putin is acting in his self-interest. So this realization probably should have come not today, but several years ago. You think about Syria, or even in Britain with the assassination of Litvinenko. So I think this has been building for some time. But I suppose the question looking ahead is, will the condemnation of the international community change Putin's behavior? And will it affect it at least at the margin? Because I don't think we should expect a complete change in the way that he's been behaving. But I suppose the question is the universal condemnation of how he's conducting foreign policy, whether it's Russian bots or assassinations, will this at least rein him back for some time? And I think the hope is it will.
I think there's an important point here, and that is that for the first 10 years of Putin's presidency, he was genuinely very popular because Russian living standards have been rising very quickly to a degree that's absolutely unknown for Russians in former times. I mean, they saw the kind of barrenness of communism and how there was nothing on the shelves. That over the past, since the year 2000, really, their living standards have risen considerably, and Putin benefited from that. And because of that, he didn't need to do anything to rally people around him. They were around him because of the popularity. Mm. Now, because of the oil price and because of Western sanctions, but mostly because of the oil price, living standards are falling, and people are grumbling, and people are also beginning to complain very vocally about corruption in Russia and people enriching themselves. So he needs another narrative, and he has needed that for the past 5 years, and that narrative is nationalism. And that is a thing that touches a very deep, raw nerve in the Russian psyche, and he is using it completely without any hesitation to galvanize Russian public opinion behind him, and therefore he needs a foreign threat to pose to show the Russians we are under threat.
Well, we were going to move on, but just on that point then, I wonder about the Football World Cup. And there's been some good writing, certainly in the British presses, about how it's erroneous for politicians to sort of target a sporting event when they themselves haven't, for example, shut off the flow of oligarch money into this country, etc., etc. But does that not, the Football World Cup, that is, provide him with a platform? I mean, the most extreme commentators have said it's like Hitler at the Berlin Olympics, but it provides him with the platform to do proper flag-waving jingoism. Would the international community be better served by potentially boycotting it or exerting some pressure, maybe making sure that their senior officials don't attend? Is that...
Well, senior officials is one thing. Players is something completely different. I mean, one has to think of the 1980 Moscow Olympics. I was there at the time when Britain boycotted officially, but the players were allowed to come. America boycotted officially, and nobody came. And of course, in the end, it reflected rather poorly on those that didn't come, because the competition felt sort of lacking in something and skewed. Overwhelmingly, people who support football want to see teams playing. It doesn't matter where they play. They could be playing on the moon or in Africa or anywhere, as long as they get to play. Now, whether or not Putin can exploit that for political purposes, I don't think he really can. People don't really care who's standing on the podium. They want to know what's happening on the field. Mm-hmm. That's where it matters. So boycotting of officials going to stand with him on the podium, that's fine. But not to send teams there would be a mistake.
I think it's lucky that Sepp Blatter isn't ensconced anymore at FIFA, because he probably would have started looking at the moon as a possible. So let's move on. There's widespread speculation that the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, has been in Beijing. This follows reports by media in Japan and the United States that he travelled to China on his first foreign visit since assuming power back in 2011. This is fascinating, and I'm most fascinated perhaps by the actual sort of logistics, the mechanics of this, the idea of him in the green train heading to Beijing and nobody knows who's on board. It sounds all rather mysterious, but it would be a plausible thing for him to do from the Pyongyang perspective, but also from the Beijing perspective?
Yes, I think it's not your typical state visit, is it? Where there's a, obviously he is a I think he would find it difficult, given the sanctions that North Korea is currently under, to make any sort of formal visit. So I don't think we should be surprised that he's taken what looks like to be quite a covert route to meet with China, because quite clearly North Korea's economic existence depends on China. And where Xi Jinping stands vis-a-vis Kim Jong-un is probably the single most important relationship in terms of North Korea's future. So I think he probably is there. There are rumors, reports in the Chinese press that it's his sister who's being sent in the green train. And the, we are talking about two countries where the media is not free. So I'm waiting for the Chinese people with social media to snap and post it, and then we might get some confirmation if it's him or his sister or no one at all.
Michael, it is interesting, isn't it? If you look at this from the Chinese perspective, I mean, it remains a compelling narrative for Beijing to have a nuclearized North Korea between China and the south of the peninsula, doesn't it? So, it, again, we're talking about what's politically expedient. I mean, it would make sense for China to try and rekindle or warm up relations which had looked a bit frosty for a while.
Well, I don't know that the Chinese really want to see a nuclear North Korea. They certainly want to see a separate North Korea that is not united with South Korea and does not allow American troops right up to the Chinese border. That would be something that they would never really accept. I think they are as worried as many other countries by what look like some fairly irresponsible nuclear adventurism by North Korea. And they have indeed joined in some of the sanctions, but they don't want to cripple North Korea because, A, if they do that, they have no control at all over what happens, and B, the regime could collapse, and that would cause huge numbers of refugees to cross over the border. It would be an almost impossible situation in humanitarian terms to deal with. They want a sort of orderly change, and they want to be able to retain influence. They also want to know whether this negotiation with President Trump, this direct face-to-face meeting, will it happen? And if so, what are the cards the North Koreans are going to play? What are they going to say? And there would be probably some very useful mutual briefing on either side as to how likely they think this is going to be and what's on the table.
And I guess that's the point, isn't it? And whether they meet or not, if they did meet, let's say hypothetically that that's what's happened, all eyes would be on that meeting with the South, of course, and then this meeting potentially with Trump. How do you think the Chinese would approach the discussion about that meeting? Would it be, as Michael says, to try and sort of sound out what might potentially be on the table? Would they have some kind of chips of their own that they would want to see sort of played by proxy, do you think?
They might do. I think if Trump met with Kim Jong-un, it would be historic for the U.S. president to sit down with the leader of North Korea. And I guess the question is, what is the end game for both countries? What do they most want to see? And I think for a lot of people in the West, denuclearization and potentially reunification with South Korea would be the most stable democratic outcome. But for China, it is, as Michael says, for them, it's two things. They want the status quo because they don't want a destabilized country sending mass migration across their border. They have the largest contiguous land border with North Korea, probably even, I think it's even longer than with South Korea. And then secondly, they don't want to lose a buffer between them and a United States, which is increasingly more antagonistic towards China than the previous Obama administration had been. And so I think for China, they would want to work out what Kim Jong-un's ultimate aim is. And that, I think, is a big, big unknown. But I suppose the other thing to say is when Trump sits down with anyone, there is a perception amongst White House staff that gets leaked, which is he wakes up not knowing what he's going to decide that day. I'm not quite sure how a sit-down between Trump and Kim Jong-un will play out and whether what we take away will actually be what the agreement will be.
Well, Michael, you've watched meetings, I guess, over a number of years now between political figures who I possibly have seen, you know, even further apart on the spectrum than Trump and Kim Jong-un. Do you think this will happen? Is there enough invested from all of the stakeholders in this to facilitate that discussion, do you think?
Well, Trump clearly wants it because he thinks it's a huge grand gesture that will distract public opinion from his other difficulties at home, his domestic difficulties. It makes him look like a statesman. It makes him look brave. It gives him a sort of macho image. It gives him everything he wants. But those around him, knowing very well that he is so wildly unpredictable, exactly as Linda said, you know, they don't really know what he'll say, are deeply nervous and more nervous now than they were. And indeed, the two newcomers in the White House, namely John Bolton, National Security Advisor, and the new Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, they are probably terrified of this idea and hostile to it. Mm. So they may start putting up preconditions, which eventually kill the whole thing off anyway. But it is quite a risk sending statesmen out on a sort of wild mission on their own. We saw this with Reagan and Gorbachev in Reykjavik, where Reagan went out to meet his great adversary. You know, he had no time for the Soviets, but he was ready to go and meet face to face. And he got carried away. So he said, why don't we put all our nuclear weapons on the table and then scrap the lot? Let's get rid of all of them. And all his Western allies said, Ronnie, are you out of your mind? You know, what are you doing? You know, you can't control guys when they're in the meeting room with the sound buzzing in their head thinking we're going to change history.
And that's a sobering thought, because Ronald Reagan, looking back now, seems like a sort of well-qualified, vastly experienced
model
statesman.
Of moderation.
Well, let's talk a bit more about Donald Trump, though, next, and particularly some of those domestic preoccupations. Let's look in particular at the recent episode of 60 Minutes, where adult film actress Stormy Daniels said she'd been threatened to keep quiet about her alleged affair with Trump more than a decade ago, of course. Linda, one of the things that really strikes me about this is there's been plenty of examples of US presidents past who've had brushes with lots of kind of fairly salacious conduct or misconduct. But never can there have been so many women coming forward with stories like this about the incumbent, you know, the sitting US president. Is it because of Trump's just brazen approach to these issues? And it was the same on when he was on the campaign trail before even taking office. What has prevented it from the scandal from engulfing him? He seems completely Teflon coated still at the moment.
Be interesting to see how it plays out. They clearly were worried about it before the campaign because she was offered, what, $130,000 or so right before the presidential campaign so that she wouldn't tell her story about how he had an affair with an adult porn actress. And then, of course, there were other things during the campaign which were just completely unbelievable in a traditional kind of way that would have sank any other candidate. The Access Hollywood tapes, the, you know, the allegations. Mm. So it's in many ways very typical, I think, of the Trump candidacy and persona, is that you have these contradictions. So yes, the people around him were concerned enough, and I think that's why the 60 Minute interview was very interesting, because she said, yeah, yes, I took the money, who wouldn't take the money, but they also threatened me, and I, you know, and she's very, very brazen in accepting it, but they were clearly worried that this would hurt Trump's candidacy. And yet, with all the other things that actually came out during the campaign, we found that it really didn't. I think if you look at some of the memoirs have come out, including Hillary Clinton's. The belief was just those secret recordings of him making these lewd comments about women would have been enough to sink a conventional candidate. And yet, we know the outcome.
And still he continues. What do you make, Michael, of the Trump camp? You were talking a moment ago about on the sort of foreign policy stage, how his advisors would be uncertain as to the calls he'd make on a given day. Does he wake up on the wrong side of the bed or not? They're keeping their counsel for the moment. Do you think have they stopped worrying about the potential damage that these sorts of claims could do? Do they think, well, look, it simply we're in a new paradigm where this just doesn't impact the man.
Well, I think if they worry too much, they'd have their head in their hands all day long, every day, thinking, what is he going to do now and what further damage can he do to his image? In a way, he's protected by his own claim that anything that is hostile to him is simply fake news. And we got to this point where it doesn't matter what people accuse him of. He just says fake news, and sends out a tweet. And then, of course, those that can't stand him don't hate him any... Well, they hate him even more, but it has no effect. Those that support him will support him in any case, because for them what matters is whether he can deliver the promises that he's made on jobs and on making America great again and all that sort of thing. Those are his core supporters, and they will take in and believe the accusation that it's all just fake news made up by the liberal media. So in a way, I think his supporters will distance himself... Sorry, his advisers in the White House will distance themselves from these rather tawdry allegations which are coming up all the time and say, well, frankly, that is the president's affair. It is a personal matter. It's nothing to do with us. And there's nothing we can do about it.
And Linda, it's interesting. If you look at the 60 Minutes audience, it was the biggest in, I think, almost a decade. Some over 21 million Americans. Who are... What's that demographic tuning in? Are they opponents of Trump who are watching to confirm there were suspicions? Are they supporters watching in some sort of strange, mawkish celebration of the man's... the worst of the man's excesses? I can't marry up the idea that people are watching in their tens of millions and yet his poll ratings or disapproval or approval ratings stay completely consistent.
I would suspect the audience is a mixture of the two. I think there are probably those who are watching to see what the liberal media has to say about their president. And I think there are others who are tuning in to, well, to work out if there's anything here that could topple Trump. Because what I mentioned before about that payment to keep her quiet, that's being discussed as a potential misuse of campaign funds. It came from his lawyer. So I think there's probably element of that. But I think her viewing, the viewing figures for her interview, which actually was the entire, both halves of this very popular TV magazine show, her ratings were higher than when Trump appeared.
Well, and this was the kind of the corollary that I was going to ask you about, Michael. What does the fact that not only that audience draws more than the man who's now in the office, but the fact that, and let's be fair, actually Stormy Daniels has done rather well. She's obviously making a lot of money out of this. She's actually appeared and talked with some degree of erudition, and she articulated her disappointment, her fear at what could happen as a result of the threats that were made allegedly by people close to the president very well. I mean, is it a damning indictment of the, I don't know, the US political realm, the US media perhaps, that some of the more articulate commentary is coming from Stormy Daniels rather than from the well-paid commentariat?
She is a very savvy and shrewd woman, and she knows what she can get. She knows where the chips lie, and she knows that she's in a strong position at the moment. She also knows that the world, or particularly America, is focused on what she is going to say, which gives her a considerable degree of power. I don't think there's much that the assistants around Trump can do about it. I think the media comments are simply waiting to see what the public reaction is. I mean, it's all very well for the liberal media to say, this is an outrage, you know, we've seen her on television, we've heard her damning evidence, Trump can't survive, and he does survive. And therefore, the liberal commentariat, as it were, is simply keeping quiet to see how it plays out.
As well they might. Now, as we've been talking about, I guess, in a sense, every nationality has its own stereotypes. Some people like to embrace it more than others, of course. We thought we'd ask, is it okay for you to use your nationality as an excuse for any kind of misdeeds? This follows the story of a waiter in Vancouver who was fired for being rude to customers, but replied when asked that he was simply being French. Linda, you're a dual national, I believe. Does that give you twice the opportunity to excuse any excessive behaviours?
I don't really invoke it, but I have certainly been in seminars and meetings with people who will say things like, I'm South African, so I'm just going to be direct. And then they just lay it out straight. And actually, I thought that was quite a welcome, you know, you may as well say what you're like in case you have any cultural misunderstandings. But that's not a misdeed. That's basically trying to say, we know that cultures are different. People communicate in different ways. Some cultures are excessively polite. Others are very direct. So just so you know, I don't mean any offense. I'm just very direct. So I actually think it's quite a welcome thing to say.
Michael, in brief, do you ever use your nationality as an excuse for anything?
Oh, of course. I say, I'm not sure that I quite agree with you, which means I think you're a complete raving lunatic, and that maybe I'd be interested, which means I really want to do this. You know, the understatement is the British way of doing it. I would like to pretend I'm Italian and therefore I could get away with flirting with everybody all the time, but I don't think the Brits can do that.
No, we're far too well-mannered for that kind of thing. Michael and Linda, it's been great fun. Thank you very much. That's Linda Yu and Michael Binion, our guests today on Midori House. The programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Amber Roberts, and our studio manager was David Stevens. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.